Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talks to Graham Stewart about how Hitler entrenched his power across all aspects of German life in the 1930s.
In the last programme, we looked at Hitler's coming to power and becoming Chancellor on the 30th of January. And I think in this programme, where we're going to be looking at the peacetime years of Hitler's rule, insofar as peace is ever a sensible term to apply to his attitudes, I think it would be useful for people to turn back and listen to that previous programme if they haven't done so. But nevertheless, each programme is designed to stand on its own. So we begin this time with Adolf Hitler becoming Chancellor of Germany on the 30th of January 1933, a part of a process of quite rapid governmental and political change over the previous few years. And there was no inherent reason to believe that Hitler coming to power would necessarily end that period of rapid change. The majority of the cabinet were people who looked not to Hitler, but to Papen, who very much had an instrumentalist transactional view towards Hitler. And Hitler himself was only one among a number of competitors for lasting power on the political right, let alone more generally in German society. And the key thing he did in 1933 was to consolidate his position, employing terror against political opponents. And if you visit Berlin, you will know that there is now an impressive memorial to the number of Reichstag deputies who were murdered by the Nazi regime in 33 and subsequently. And he also exploited the opportunities offered by the arson attack on the Reichstag on the 27th of February in order to suspend civil liberties, attack the communists, and introduce mass arrests. I don't propose to get involved in the question of the Reichstag fire. It's fairly clear cut what happened. What's more interesting is how Hitler used the crisis and the sense of crisis which he had engendered in order to suspend the constitution. Apropos of which, it is quite shameful to note that one of the major British historians on the Nazi regime, Professor Richard Evans, referred to the British government's position over Brexit exit in 2019 as akin to the Reichstag fire and its exploitation. I think that was a quite shameful and irresponsible comparison. The process of Hitlerian use of political violence, murder, and oppression was totally different to situations in Britain. Anyway, concentration camps begin to be opened, the most prominent being Dachau near Munich, which was opened in March 1933. It can still be visited. And they were established as detention centres for protective custody, meaning detention without trial. They were, in fact, extraordinarily brutal in their methods and intended outcome. There were about 3,500 prisoners by the summer of 35. That might not sound many, but of course every single person detained and brutalized was a warning to everybody else. And the system soon expanded with major camps, including Sachsenhausen, opening in 36. I visited Sachsenhausen anew 2 weeks ago. It remains as all concentration camps are, a shocking account of how a society and a political system can develop and treat those it dislikes. And in Sachsenhausen, of course, those who were brutalized were not just Jews. Jews, but also a whole lot of other categories that the Nazi regime wanted to extirpate. And also Buchenwald following in 1937. Helped by its appeal to many of the young, violence was at the very heart of Nazism. It was a creed that required the destruction of alleged enemies, and that aggression was deployed across the country to establish the Nazi order. Nazism was not only a system of brutality in one part of Germany, it was intended, as it actually was, to provide an incessant and insistent and consistent brutality across the whole of the German space. And it was claimed by the Nazis that domestic dissidents had to be prevented in order to strengthen Germany for war. In other words, there was, in many respects, in terms of domestic politics, a mobilization or intended mobilization of the country from war from the outset, well before there was actually a position to go to war. It's interesting, incidentally, because it's attracted so much popular attention to turn to Christopher Isherwood's work, because of course the film Cabaret, which was a very successful 1966 musical and then becoming a 1972 film, and there's recently been another play, a theatrical version of it in London, was based on the work of Christopher Isherwood, his semi-autobiographical novel, Goodbye to Berlin, published at the end of the 30s, but set in 1931. And in it, the rise of the Nazis is a deadly theme with their violence, their takeover of the cabaret, the scene in the beer garden in which the song Tomorrow Belongs to Me is revealed both as a Nazi theme song and as an intimidating pledge. Isherwood himself also, in his novel Mr. Norris Changes Trains, which came out in 1935, and he'd been in Berlin to teach English, describes those who were pleased by the Nazi takeover. And he makes it quite clear that in his mind, and there's no doubt that he was absolutely accurate in this, it was not simply the Nazis who liked the new Hitlerian regime. He wrote about those who smiled approvingly at these youngsters in their big swaggering boots who were going to upset the Treaty of Versailles. They thrilled with a furtive, sensual pleasure like schoolboys, because the Jews, their business rivals, and the Marxists, a vaguely defined minority of people who didn't concern them, had been satisfactorily found guilty of the defeat and the inflation and were going to catch it. And in those phrases, I think Isherwood very much reflects what was a theme noted by other commentators of the period. Of course, ironically, Hitler's violence was directed not simply at those who were his, as it were, his ostensible victims, but also rather like Stalin and his brutalization of communists whom he didn't like, was also directed at those within his own movement. So Hitler had not followed the advice of his ally Ernst Röhm, who wanted to transform the Nazi SA movement, of which he was the head, into a kind of militia-type army that would incorporate the professional military and remove their independence. Interestingly enough, there was an analogous tension within fascism in Italy, and was, of course, to be an analogous tension in the Francoist regime between the Falange and other elements of the regime. Anyway, this form of Nazi revolution was unacceptable to Hitler and to the army, as indeed it was to be to Franco, and Hitler didn't want rivals. Röhm was murdered. The SA was severely weakened in what became known as the Night of the Long Knives, which in practice was a period of violence from the 30th of June June to the 2nd of July 1934, of murdering those suspected of involvement in a conservative conspiracy against the Nazis, included an individual we discussed last time, General Schleicher, who'd been, of course, Minister of Defense. And there's no doubt at all that there was a conspiracy against Hitler. It had sought, ironically, to exploit in part military unease with the SA, but had failed to win the backing of Hindenburg. So there are a number of groups maneuvering for position in 1934, and Hitler uses violence to crush them. As I said, the parallels with Stalin and Stalin's use of brutality in the 30s against other communists is very apparent, as well as against the army, is very apparent. Hitler himself was resolved to control the army. Hindenburg dies on the 2nd of August 34, and after that, Hitler goes in for his the commonplace of dictators, which is aggrandizing the number of offices they hold. So he adds the office of the president to that of the chancellor, and as head of state now, as president, he becomes supreme commander of the armed forces. That's very significant. That is a very different position to that which he had held when he gains power at the end of January 33. Now, the army leadership, who thought it would bind Hitler to the army, suggests to Hitler that there should be an oath of unconditional loyalty to him as Führer, leader, to be taken by every officer and soldier in the armed forces on the 2nd of August. And this oath was underlined in subsequent army education sessions. Now, I think that again is significant, the degree to which the military, although in a way not all army officers sympathize with all aspects of Nazism, and in the case of many, there was a social disdain for the buffoonery and the malice and the stupidity of a lot of the Nazis. Nevertheless, there is now an integration of the armed forces with the Hitlerian regime in 1934. And I think it's fair to say that although we now quite rightly honor those who in 1944 in the July bomb plot sought to assassinate Hitler and to replace him, I think it's worth pointing out that many army leaders, many army figures did not do that in 44, and that Hitler would have found it far harder to achieve his purposes had there not been that very strong complicity by military leaders from this very early stage. Hitler needed the army to support his aggressive policies, his determination to tolerate no other views, and also, ironically, his dissatisfaction with the army. In other words, he was dissatisfied with the army, but he needed the army to accept his position in order that he should be able to limit any independence by army leaders and eventually replace them by those whom he considered loyal. At the same time, Hitler promised the army the key role of providing the means to achieve German greatness. So there is that bargain, as it were, implicit bargain. There's not the kind of explicit bargain you're going to see with, for example, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, but there is an implicit bargain. Moreover, although these men were wary of the SS, and trying to retain their autonomy, they were basically sympathetic to the Nazi regime. Nazi popularity among Germans can be explained because, in part, as we discussed last time, the movement promised a revival of greatness. In addition, Nazism appeared committed to opening up social mobility, to removing barriers to privileges for both the middle and the working classes, especially when it brought about full employment, which it tried to do, and to a degree, partly to do with inflating the money supply, to a degree to which it did by 1936. Moreover, the National Socialism that the Nazis offered came with a sort of populist tone, for example, the anti-Semitism, that was very different to that of the other conservative parties and also to that of the SPD, the socialists. This particular faith in a German community, which was one that the Nazis advocated, but one which looked back to German nationalism and the particular way it had been advanced in the late 19th century, helped to maintain hostility towards those who were stigmatized very unfairly as lacking national identity and loyalty. So, for example, a large number of Jewish Germans had fought in the First World War, but now, in order to meet the nature of Nazi ideology, they in some way were pushed outside the national community. Democratic pluralism was presented as inherently wrong, and there was both the push and the pull of propaganda, with the two elements linked in a response to the spectacle of the Nazi regime. And the Nazis were good at spectacle, rather crude spectacle, but they were good at spectacle, whether their mass rallies or whether the films they commissioned, their interest in flight, the particular music and statuary they commissioned, etc., etc., and also the ritual incantation of the leader associated with Hitler. And Hitler is an example, one of the possibly most apparent examples of the pernicious nature of religion in the 20th century, because in practical terms, this was the new religion, national religion, which many, most Germans in some way either endorsed or accepted in the 1930s, and which was certainly pushed by both state and the institutions of the state. And you know, one has to understand this in partly in religious terms. That was Hitler was the prophet. He was a prophet looking towards a future, and his particular type of religion was very much a national religion rather than an international religion, like, for example, Christianity or Islam. An emphasis on race led to the dehumanization of the racial outsider, and there were two clear-cut categories in the Nazi sort of prospectus, Aryans and non-Aryans, with the latter being the so-called blood enemy. Indeed, they were treated as superhumans and subhumans. A stress on the Aryan Volk people challenged the culture of Weimar with its individualism, its notions of progress and liberty in terms of the celebration and protection, legal and otherwise, of the self. And those ideas, those concepts, that legality was now associated with a castigated liberalism. Moreover, the focus on the Aryan ensured that serious regional, political, institutional, religious, social and economic differences and divisions within Germany, all of which had continued as part of unification. They'd helped to make unification possible in the 1860s and 1870s. They'd continued under the Wilhelmine Second Reich. They'd continued under Weimar, but they were now deliberately downplayed. And this was, you know, this was an extreme accentuation of the process, which there had been an element of that under the Second Reich. There had been an element in particular of that under the pressures of the length of the First World War, but this was now very much pushed. More crudely and vigorously, the Nazi agenda of national strength and renewal and racial consciousness and, in my view, really harsh aggressiveness, answered to a sort of historical awareness and set of references in which a focus on alleged external threats in the present and future were then extrapolated onto the past. And that was very much a byproduct of a totalitarian drive. The whole of history was to be mobilized in a continuing process that linked past, present, and future. And with the Aryan Volk, or people as led by its leader, the clear actor and leader in this process. So there was a meshing of national and racial themes in terms of belief about destiny. Destiny was very much a theme and language of this period, and destiny was not subject to discussion, still less debate or democratic verdict. So the present was to be employed in taking forward a sort of vision of the past that was at once national and racial. And this was a kind of millenarianism, a kind of inherent extremism that is necessary to understand if one wants to consider the Nazi so-called peacetime years, because as I mentioned at the outset, peace was very much not the Nazi prospectus. Now, I wonder if I can continue, and there are many things to talk about, including the development of economic mobilization, the series of brutal expropriatory and violent treatment of the Jewish Germans. But I wonder if we can take some points from you, Graham, at the moment.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Professor Black. There are, as you say, a huge number of different issues to tease out rather further. I wonder if I might start by asking you, how much of what followed, how much of what was the German Reich by the mid-1930s, so after Hindenburg's death in 1934, how much of that Germany as materialized under Hitler in the mid-30s should have or could have come as a surprise to the averagely aware German in January 1933?
Well, I think they might have been surprised at how successful he was. In a way, as I mentioned, there had been a number of changes of government, and the assumption, I think, would be that Germany would be another state. I mean, why on earth should it follow the Italian pattern or the Soviet pattern of political apparent stability? I mean, Mussolini had been in for a number of years. The communist regime was strongly entrenched in the Soviet Union. Why should it follow that pattern as opposed to patterns of other governments, France, for example, or Spain, both of which at that period had been having many changes? On the other hand, they could scarcely have been surprised at the brutality and the use of violence. But I suppose one way you could look at it was that the state, as with the suppression of communism in the beginning of the 20s, end of the teens, and also as with the stopping of the Munich Putsch, the state had shown an ability to deal with the extremes. What I think is more instructive is Hitler from 34. From 34 on, I think his influence over the armed forces is much stronger, and that makes it highly unlikely that the armed forces are going to be used or willing to be used in order to act against Hitler. Now, ironically, of course, there was a plot in 38 organized by Ludwig Beck, the chief of the army general staff, in order for a coup. But interestingly enough, Beck's plan, and you may have seen fictional reference to it in Robert Harris's novel and I think excellent film version Munich recently, that plot suffered from a lack of wider support within the military, and Hitler had already then furthered his control by sacking Werner von Blumberg, the Minister of War, and Werner von Fritsch, the army commander. What I would say is the political options for Germany to move in a different direction had been closed in by the late summer of 34.
Did Germans of all classes at this period, did they take much interest in the sort of the prototype, which was fascist Italy, Did they say, well, you know, here's a European country which appears to have got its act together under fascism, if they took Mussolini's boasts at face value? Or was there a more chauvinistic attitude that, you know, what happened on the other side of the Alps was not really relevant to Germany?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, for obvious reasons, the socialists and the communists and the liberals, all of whom had suffered under Mussolini, were scarcely going to see Italy as an example. Hitler himself was always interested in Mussolini, and as you may know, made visits to Italy later in the 30s. But there was an inherent incompatibility between a national exceptionalism based on the idea of an Aryan Volk and the notion of emulating Italy. So I wouldn't say that that was the case. I mean, for the Germans, the frustration was to be that the country that in many respects they saw as a potential partner because of what they saw as an Aryan essentialism, what they saw as its international strength, which was Britain, of course, was completely opposed to Germany. The conservative politics of Baldwin were antipathetical to Germany. So, you know, people make these very flawed and stupid judgments that because the British didn't fight the Germans in 36, 37, or 38, they were in some way philo-Germans or philo-Nazis even, which is rubbish. There was a complete contrast between the ethos of the vast majority of British conservatives. And from that point of view, although it's not without its interest, Simon Heffer's excellent edition of Chips Channon's diary, and Chips Channon was somebody who had far-right leanings, really is a presenting of an atypical figure. And, you know, my own view is that I think Heffer, who is one of our best historians of the current generation, it's a pity he's wasted so much time and talent on such a mediocrity.
Should we, when is the stage in which this Nazi government really becomes Hitler's personal dictatorship? You mentioned the armed oath and Hitler's power over the armed forces. Were there any real, after Hindenburg dies, are there any real checks on Hitler's personal authority, or should we see this as almost a one-man state?
Well, there's always checks on a dictator's power. I mean, you can't have secret policemen at every elbow. And of course, the very nature of an ideology of millenarian revivalism means that you find that the fact that the majority of the public don't necessarily live at your pace of enthusiasm and commitment operates as a check. But I should imagine you're not thinking of that. And those checks are very important. I should imagine you're not so much thinking of that. You're thinking of institutional and political checks. Well, there are, but they're more complicated. First of all, Nazism was a chaos, pretending to be a movement, pretending to be a government, pretending to be the future. It's a chaos of divergent tendencies, of egotists who are mediocre and mediocrities who are egotistical, of little empires that compete with each other. So all of that helps to act as an impasse, so that in a way there are, as it were, agents of the Nazi state in particular places, and they often will resist rival instructions, unwelcome pressures, and that endlessly leads to as it were, the responsibility devolving upwards to sort this out. And of course, Hitler himself was both lazy and stupid, as well as being vicious and horribly nasty. So there were a hell of a lot of problems within the state. And then out, as far as outside or for the cognate parts of the state, clearly, there are those who, as it were, make deals with the Nazi regime, partly because they sympathize with it, partly for transactional reasons, generally for both, but with varying extent. So you can look at the military in that respect. You can look at a lot of big business in that respect. You can look at landowners in that respect, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't mean they necessarily do what the government wants, or even more, what Hitler might want. And Hitler is not exactly a master of consistency once you move away from the rhetoric. There has also been, if you look at another incompetent, badly organized, a messianic state, which is the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, there is disorganization, incompetence, etc., etc. And there is also the brutalization of those who defy it. But in the Soviet Union, brutalization is even further. They've tried to destroy entire social categories. And I think it might be said that the destructiveness of the Russian Civil War and the coincident and subsequent class warfare and political warfare by the communists against their opponents means that by the early 30s, Stalin is more in a position to, as it were, enforce his malign purposes than Hitler is. And I think that that's always a problem for the Hitlerian regime, that it is vastly violent, but its violence is not as geared to its vision of a efficient future as the communist one is. The notion of a racial future is not in practice an efficient one. In fact, you can turn it on its head and say it's exactly inefficient. Brutalizing most of the talented people in the Third Reich is hardly the way to fulfill Hitler's aspirations for Germany as a great power. Now, you might make the same point about the Soviet Union. I think the same point is true to a degree. But the racial emphasis at the center of Nazism is essentially not just destructive of others. It also is based on no semblance of logic at all, other than one that is that of the of a kind of perversity of human imagination.
It's odd, isn't it, that this illogic at the heart of Nazism. I mean, on the one hand, it's a nostalgic, reactionary form of Volkish nationalism, socially conservative in many respects. On the other hand, it's obsessed with supposedly forward-looking kind of scientific modernity. How is it it didn't collapse under this monument of illogic?
Well, Germany itself was a strong economy, massive resources, coal, iron, agriculture, etc. And there were, unfortunately, many Germans who went along with the notion of a national community, the Volksgemeinschaft of the created in the Nazi image. And, that a lot of people, a lot of people profited from that. Let's be clear about this. A lot of people bought seized assets at cheap prices. A lot of people like strutting around in the apparatus of the Nazi state and its parallels. A lot of people liked the, as it were, the cheap money policies of expanding the nation, national employment and so on. And, many people were taken in by willingly Let's be clear about this. This is not a question of false consciousness, which is the usual language on the left about working class people who don't vote for socialism or communism. Well, you don't get a chance to vote for communism, but don't vote for socialism. This was actually a lot of people wanted to believe in Hitler's pronounced cult of personality, sense of historical mission, etc., etc., etc. I mean, to Hitler, of course, what he saw as racial purity was a key aspect of his mission. It was, you know, both means and goals. And, you know, it was one that they used a lot of effort to disseminate. I mean, the New York Times noted in 1936, it's a miracle of radio that it wheeled 60 million Germans into a single crowd to be played upon by a single voice. Now, that voice was, of course, Hitler's through his, you know, pet poodle Goebbels. And of course, Goebbels gave out the so-called People's Receiver, which was an inexpensive radio designed to link Hitler with the people. Now, again, you know, you could see this in communist regimes. The Soviet Union was also keen to indoctrinate in this period. So, there was a book some years ago, Dark Continent by Mark Mazzava. A lot of it's sort of rather turgid, but he makes in it a very good point. I mean, it's not a point that will surprise you and me, but it's a very good point, which is that we would like to believe that most people are inherently liberal and would not wish to turn to the extremes, but or what we would define as the extremes. But Mazzava's point was how popular a lot of the what we would call extreme messages were. And I think that's unfortunately true. And obviously this was enhanced by the particular difficulties economically and socially and politically of the 1930s, but it wasn't unique to that decade and it remains the case today.
I mean, it is part of the depressing aspect of Nazism that so many people were prepared to go along with it. You spoke about the...
Can I just say, not go along with it, an vast number of people believed in it. This was a religion that was a civic religion that many subscribed to. And they subscribed to it with their hearts as well as their wallets.
The millions of Germans who had supported in the 1920s and early 30s the Social Democrats, the SPD, were they, do you think they were amongst this number who actually went for, actually, this is the kind of radical government we quite like? We had thought we wanted it from the left, but it transpires the right has answered what we wanted done. Do you think that happened? Or, you know, other than those leaders of the SPD who are, you know, arrested or murdered, your average SPD-leaning German in the early 30s, what do you sense happened to them? They lie low and become servile, or they actually move towards being sympathetic to the new regime?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, some do lie low. And in fact, the remark made by the New York Times is not accurate. Not everybody listens to the new stuff from Goebbels. Not everybody approves of it. So that is fallacious. But on the other hand, I don't think there's any doubt that many people did incorporate themselves. And you've got to remember, again, a point that has often been made in modern politics of the last 30, 40 years, is the far left and the far right are often much closer together than either of them might like to image, not just close in their means, but also close in the ability of people to move from one to t'other. I mean, look at the way in which former Nazis came to work for the East German system. You know, some, of course, came to work for the West German system as well. So I think one has to be aware that in a sense, it's not necessarily a problem to explain why what had been a mass movement in difficult circumstances, and let's be clear about this, the Nazi brutality was not just a matter of taking out leaders. They suppressed publications, political organizations, political movements that were non-Nazi. So that makes it very difficult. It's very difficult to run a democratic political movement, which is what socialism, liberalism, conventional conservatism are, if you are facing the brutality of the far left or the far right. It's just very difficult to do so. And obviously within their own household or close friendship units, or just the privacy of one's own soul and conscience, one can reject what is coming it at you incessantly, but it's not then easy to necessarily do anything about it.
We're in the period in the 1930s, the period before the Holocaust, but nevertheless a period of extraordinarily brutal persecution of German Jews and other minorities as well. Who spoke out against this? Obviously not effectively, but can we trace brave individuals or even groups who tried to say, no, this isn't on?
Yes, I mean, there are people who speak out against it, but I think it's fair to say that the state is able, and to a considerable extent, community pressure on behalf of the state is able to suppress or at least direct attention away from those who were critical. And I think it's fair to say that the harshness of the regime is one which is accepted with, I mean, there's no equivalent, for example, to what happens in far northern Spain in the late 1940s, when you've actually got armed resistance to the Francoist regime. Now, it wouldn't have been easy, certainly wouldn't have been easy, but I think there's very little space left for a civil society in the sense of a representation of different views to that of the government in Nazi Germany, same in Soviet Union. So in a way, again, it's not a false question. That's a ridiculous remark if I was to make that. But it's a question that, in a sense, doesn't bear much reference to the reality of Germany on the ground in the late 1930s.
Well, we will have to leave it there, unfortunately. But Professor Jeremy Black, author of A Brief History of Germany, for talking us through this dark period in Germany in the 1930s. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Listeners may find interesting, there is a book by me called Holocaust History and Memory, which is published by the University of Indiana Press. And I go in greater detail into the Holocaust, including prior to the establishment of the extermination camps. So listeners may find that of rather, well, it was the only book I've ever written, and I've written many books, in which I had a persistent headache of the most unpleasant type all the way through, that they might find it of interest.
I'm sure they would. Professor Black, thank you very much indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.